Hello, my name is Joe Austin, and I'm your host and producer for today's episode of Legal Matters, an original program produced in the North Carolina Reading Service studio. For the next half hour, we're going to speak about topics, and we want to champion your legal rights to obtain equal access and full participation in our community. And we want you to achieve your goals of independent living. Every fourth Tuesday of each month, you can find us here providing news and information from federal and state agencies as well as nonprofit organizations that promote information on laws supporting independent living. And in today's episode, our guest is Xavier Lightfoot, an attorney with Warden Smith, PA, here in their Raleigh office. Xavier, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me today, Joe. It's good to be with you and your listeners today.
Well, we're so glad to have you, and we've got a topic today that you might think that after the hashtag MeToo phenomenon, there wouldn't be so much of a need for tutorials and programs about the subject of illegal harassment, but I guess it's human nature that this is an issue that is ongoing. And so before we get into it, though, Xavier is an employment and personal injury lawyer with Warden Smith. And before we get into our subject matter, Xavier, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure, happy to. Thanks again, Joe. Just a little bit about my background. I am an employment and personal injury attorney, as Joe mentioned, practicing with Warden Smith in our Raleigh location. We are a North Carolina law firm that has a geographic footprint from the mountains to the beach, and I'm fortunate to be in our Raleigh location. I grew up originally in Columbus, Georgia, and also in between in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Went to undergrad at East Carolina University, where I majored in accounting and finance. And then I went to law school at North Carolina Central University, and then I started with Warden Smith immediately following graduating from North Carolina Central.
Well, thank you, Xavier. And let me add a few things here. I told you that if you were too modest, I was going to tell our listeners a little bit more about you. But Xavier was a cum laude graduate of North Carolina Central School of Law. And the one thing that, or several things, jumped up at me out of his resume is I will tell you, if you have to go to court, you want Xavier on your side. He is a masterful advocate, and a testament to that is, as a law student, he was first place in the national trial competition, and first place in trial advocacy in 2018, and first place in the closing argument competition intramural at Central. So Xavier is quite accomplished on his feet. And well, one thing I want to ask you about is that East Carolina undergrad, Xavier, it doesn't sound like you had a Eastern North Carolina background, but you ended up with the purple and gold. How did you get there?
Yeah, that's a great question, Joe. And I'll tell you, I enjoyed my time at East Carolina down in Greenville. It's just a great community. Great folks down there. I initially, when I was looking at schools and where I wanted to earn my undergraduate degree, had a good buddy who was a wrestling colleague of mine, and we grew up together, and he was a couple years ahead of me in high school, and he went off to East Carolina once he graduated and came back and just shared so many great stories and how he's got so many great academic programs, but he was also able to have a really good social life as well. And so I started looking more and more into ECU's business program because I knew at that time that I wanted to have a business background, even though I was going to go off to law school. And so it looked like I had a really good business program, the College of Business. And I mean, when I visited the campus, I immediately fell in love with Greenville, with the East Carolina University community. And I was completely sold. And so that's how I landed down in Greenville.
Well, that's great. We've got a lot of listeners down east and in eastern North Carolina. And my bride and I lived in New Bern for 27 years. Very close to Greenville. And I will tell you, there's a lot of purple and gold in New Bern. So anyway, it is a great school. It is a wonderful school. So you got a good undergraduate education and had a wonderful law school experience. Well, it doesn't seem like it was that long ago that hashtag MeToo was in the news. It was I've used the phrase phenomenon. Then here we are 3 years later, and we're still dealing with sexual harassment in the workplace. And tell us a little bit about the legal background of sexual harassment and how it fits into jurisprudence. And so I'll just turn the floor over to you, Xavier.
Thank you, Joe, and happy to. And you hit on something very important. The Me Too social movement, even though, you know, it seems like that started quite a few years ago, it's still very prevalent today in how our society views sexual harassment and sexual abuse claims. And that movement is very vibrant, and it's rightfully so, being that, you know, sexual harassment is an unfortunate common occurrence in offices and professional settings across the United States. And North Carolina is no exception. In fact, a 2017 survey from CNBC found that one-fifth of American adults have experienced some form of sexual harassment at work, and that includes 27% of all women. And so, I mean, sexual harassment has certainly had a bright light shined on it in the past few years. And, you know, when you think about sexual harassment and how it occurs in the workplace and what forms it shows up, oftentimes, you know, when I talk to individuals, they do not know exactly what is sex discrimination, what's sex harassment, sexual harassment. And so I want to spend a little bit of time about sharing just a little background of how those things have been defined under federal law and also here in North Carolina. So sexual harassment in general is a form of sex discrimination, and it violates Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 when it occurs in the workplace. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which I will refer to today in short as Title VII, it is the federal law that prohibits employment discrimination against employees and applicants based on race, color, religion, national origin, and sex. And sex includes gender, pregnancy, sexual orientation, and gender identity. The United States Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which I will refer to in short today as the EEOC, that is the federal agency that has been tasked with enforcing the federal protections provided by Title VII. However, Title VII, it only applies if your employer employs 15 or more employees. And so that's the general landscape when you look at it from the federal standpoint. And when an individual is claiming some sort of sexual harassment, generally there are two types. First, you have what's called quid pro quo harassment, which we'll talk about in just a moment. And then the second form you have is hostile work environment harassment. These are the two most common types of sexual harassment claims. When we talk about quid pro quo, all that is that's a Latin phrase that means this for that, an exchange for an exchange. It may involve unwelcome sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, and other verbal or physical conduct of a sexual nature. And that occurs when submission to the conduct is made a part of a term or condition of an individual's employment. And it could be it could be stated outright, or it may be implicit or implied. It can also be submission to or rejection of conduct which is a basis for employment decisions. So in order for an individual to successfully state a claim for quid pro quo sexual harassment, a plaintiff must show five things. First, what you got to be able to show is that you are a member in a protected class. And what that protected class means is that you are a member within a protected category under the federal law. Meaning, is this about, you know, your sex as a woman or as a man? Is this sexual orientation? Is this gender? Is this pregnancy? That's what membership in the protected class in the sexual harassment context means. Second, what you have to be able to show is that there's some type of sexual advances or advances that were unwelcome by the plaintiff. Third, you have to show harassment that was sexually motivated by the harasser. The fourth thing that the plaintiff must show is that the plaintiff's reaction to those advances were negatively affected tangible aspects of their employment. What I mean by that is it's related to some sort of compensation or promotion or hiring. And then the final thing that the plaintiff has to show is that the harassment is attributable to the employer. And this is generally the case when the harasser has a direct impact on the tangible aspects of the plaintiff's employment, meaning the harasser is the supervisor for the plaintiff. There's some sort of direct impact in that employment relationship. And that's a theory of liability known as, in the legal field, as respondent superior, when the agent of the employer is perpetuating some sort of harassment, then the employer is going to be deemed liable for that conduct. And that's what the framework looks like for a quid pro quo harassment situation. Now, generally, you know, in a quid pro quo harassment situation, like I mentioned, it requires some sort of tangible employment consequence. And that's often referred to as some sort of adverse employment action, meaning the individual who is being harassed, they either refuse to submit to the harasser's demands or subject themselves to such conduct. For example, you can have an employee who is being terminated for not submitting to, you know, some sort of implied or explicit sexual demands from their supervisor. On the other hand, hostile work environment harassment, that occurs when sexual harassment makes the workplace environment intimidating, hostile, or offensive. So you can think of unwelcome sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, and other verbal or physical conduct of a sexual nature that creates a hostile work environment when the conduct has the purpose or the effect of unreasonably interfering with the work performance. It's so pervasive that it is unreasonably interfering with the work performance. Or conduct, like I mentioned, which creates an intimidating, hostile, or offensive working environment. And so, similar to quid pro quo, there are a few things that a plaintiff must be able to show to establish the hostile work environment harassment. First thing is that the conduct must be unwelcome. Second thing is that the harassment is occurring because of the employee's protected class status. The third thing is that the harassment is attributable to the employer. And then the fourth thing is that it is so severe or pervasive enough that it changes the conditions of employment and creates an abusive environment. And that's judged by two different standards. First, it is judged by an objective standard, meaning that any reasonable person would find whatever the conduct is as abusive. And the second way that it is judged is from a subjective standard, which means that the specific employee who's in question, they found the conduct to be abusive and harassing. So unwelcome is the critical word. If it, unwelcome means unwanted. Sexual conduct is unwelcome whenever the person subjected to it considers it unwelcome. And so it is always important to remember that anyone, male or female, can be a victim of sexual harassment. The victim and the harasser can be a woman, it can be a man, and the victim or the harasser can be of the same sex. A man might harass another man, a woman might harass another woman. Likewise, you can have a woman who might harass a man. And so it's important to keep those things in mind. And that's how it's viewed generally under the federal landscape. Similar to Title VII, North Carolina also has a state law prohibiting sexual discrimination and harassment, which is known as the North Carolina Equal Employment Practices Act. And that also applies to employers with 15 or more employees. And there are many examples of conduct that rises to the level of sexual harassment, just as well as there are behaviors that can take place in the workplace which do not rise to the level of sexual harassment. So I guess to give some examples of, you know, that type of conduct that might arise to the level of sexual harassment, if you've got an individual who is repeatedly hitting on a coworker or persistently asking for a date, even when that individual has been turned down or the coworker has asked that individual to stop, that is an example of a situation that could be deemed as sexual harassment. Also making compliments that most people would consider inappropriate. Complimenting a coworker on her earrings is not necessarily sexual harassment, but complimenting her on her physical features, such as your coworker's breast, that would constitute sexual harassment. Furthermore, if you make any comments on a person's appearance, that could be considered, it can be considered sexual harassment if that individual has asked you to stop such comments. Other examples, you know, that I think most people would kind of think of, you know, touching a coworker against their will. That's, you know, that includes everything from patting a coworker on, their backside, to rape and sexual assault. Demanding sex or sexual favors, those are pretty obvious when your boss asks, you know, his secretary for a date, or, you know, promises to give, an employee that the supervisor is supervising a promotion. If they say yes, they have engaged in sexual harassment. Asking inappropriate questions about a worker's private or sex life. Persistently asking a coworker for dates. Or asking what that coworker likes to do or does not like to do in the bedroom. All of these things can constitute sexual harassment. Behaviors that do not necessarily rise to the level of sexual harassment could be dating a coworker, or just having sex with a coworker if it's consensual, engaging in flirtatious banter with a coworker, as long as that behavior is consensual and is not directed to any third party, it is not considered harassment. If you give some type of innocuous compliment to a coworker, well, if the compliment is the type of compliment you give to a stranger in which you have no reason to believe the other person would find it objectionable, then it's probably not going to rise to the level of harassment. If you make small talk about your private or your personal lives with your coworkers, that's not necessarily harassment. And also, if you choose to share the details of your sex life with a workplace friend or someone who asks for the details with whom you feel comfortable discussing such topics, then that's not going to be conduct which rises to the level of sexual harassment. And so those are just some general examples.
Xavier, let me jump in, and that's an excellent synopsis, and more than just a synopsis. I mean, you've gone into a lot of the fine points there, but let me go back to sort of the jurisprudential basis here for these for this body of law, and you've talked about it having its place in Title VII. and that which goes to the terms and conditions of employment. So I think what you're saying there is that in a way, at least in the eyes of the law, the sexual harassment becomes a term and condition, an illegal term and condition of the employment, and that's what triggers the Title VII protection. Is have I got that right?
That is absolutely correct, Joe.
And if somebody, and I'm sure it happens to you, but you know, people will come in and say from time to time they're in a hostile and work environment, and you question them about it, and it doesn't have anything to do with a protected trait or characteristic. It's the boss is coming down on them for being late to work or not doing their job, and they feel like the boss is doing it in such a way that it's offensive. But that doesn't necessarily make it illegal, does it?
No, that's correct. And those are difficult conversations to have with any individual, just because there could be there likely are situations where individuals certainly have a valid gripe or complaint as it pertains to the conditions of their workplace. It's just that, the underlying facts that make up that complaint or that gripe, they do not meet the definitions or the conduct does not relate to the terms or conditions of the employment relationship, such that it is based off of that individual's any sort of protected class or category for that individual, such that it could be considered some sort of unlawful harassment or even sexual harassment. And so those are some difficult conversations to have, especially when you've got individuals who have supervisors who do not necessarily like them, and it's obvious that the supervisors does not necessarily like the employee, and you can gather that from the conduct that the individual describes to you that is occurring. But it's important to be able to separate, what type of conduct is actually unlawful under federal and state laws, and conduct that is not necessarily unlawful, but hey, this is obviously not the best practice here, and it just seems like there's a poor work relationship. So those are some difficult conversations, especially when there's conduct that from a reasonable standpoint you can say, hey, that shouldn't be occurring, but it's not necessarily unlawful.
And sometimes you just gotta tell them like it is. That's why they call it work, and that's why they pay it to come. So, it's what we can gather from all of this is that it's based on a protected category, trait, characteristic, and although the quid pro quo wouldn't translate to other protected traits and characteristics, it would translate to some of the other protected characteristics and under federal law. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. You can have under federal law, the protected classes, as I mentioned, include race, color, religion or creed, national origin or ancestry, sex, age, physical or mental disability, veteran status, genetic information and citizenship, and so you can have harassment is a broad term, and what flows under that umbrella are a variety of different categories and protected classes, and you can have an individual who claims unlawful harassment for various different categories or classes, so it just depends on what kind of conduct is occurring and what is the basis for the conduct. It is sometimes not that it's sex related. It may be based on the individual's age, or it may be based on the individual's race. And race is, you know, not just as how we may think of it occurring. It's not just black or white. You know, you can have a black person who is who is unlawfully harassing a white individual. You can have a Native American who is unlawfully harassing someone who is white. It all can go back and forth. So it's not how we typically like to think of things, and how it may be presented. It shows up in all different types of forms, and I've dealt with a variety of those situations as well in practice.
And at least for the time being, it applies to protect LGBTQ status as well. And I say at least for the time being. The last time the Supreme Court made a ruling on that, they protected LGBTQ, but that everything seems to be in some sort of flux right now, but we'll hold on about that. I knew that we were going to have so much information here that and Xavier has been very generous with his time. We're going to split this into two parts, and Xavier's done a masterful job of laying out the basic law here of illegal harassment. And what we're going to do is we're going to end this episode and then pick back up next time with several other issues that Xavier is has prepared. But we're actually doing this in one segment here in pre-recording, but it will come out in two back-to-back episodes. So anyway, what I'm going to do now is do an outro here. We've run out of time for today's episode of Legal Matters. Please be sure to tune in next time on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 2 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 7 a.m. And then the program is available by podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. And we hope you've enjoyed this show. And like I say, we've laid out the baseline of information about illegal harassment, and in next month we're going to pick back up with issues that have to do with enforcement. And I'm going to end up here. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. After it's broadcast, you can readily find it as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org, where you'll be able to listen to it again and share it with others. If you have any comments or questions from today's episode, or wish to share a topic that you would like for us to address, please call us at 919-832-5138, and you can reach us via email at info@ncreading.org. Thank you so much. We'll be back.